welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sennett, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, American unrest. And Richard, I base our conversation today on the most recent piece that you wrote for Defining Ideas. And there you take on something that has been in the air for the past 3 or 4 months, beginning with the George Floyd case in Minneapolis, and then all the subsequent incidents we've had between police officers and African-American individuals that have resulted in death or severe injury. And those incidents have been held up by groups like Black Lives Matter and many media outlets, many corporations, many celebrities. I mean, the list goes on as evidence of what they call systemic or institutional racism, structures of oppression. That's the kind of terms that you'll hear. And you begin this piece for DI by writing, I'm quoting you here, "This idea rests on a wholly misguided understanding of the facts on the ground." Explain what you mean by that.
A charge of institutional racism means that you have to be able to find some racism somewhere within the system. And the charge also means that you have to find some sort of events that validate the particular charge. And in this particular case, there's a very vivid image that nobody's been able to put out of their minds of Derek Chauvin sitting on the head and maybe the neck of George Floyd for 8 minutes and 45 seconds, being relatively blithe and indifferent to what happens. He then is left. Floyd is taken in an ambulance to the hospital and he dies. And immediately all the words go out, "This is an instance of systematic racism." There are two kinds of answers to this question. I think it's important to put them separately on the table. The first one is that if the definition of systematic racism involves an act by an individual policeman or even four policemen, which would be conceitedly inconsistent with the rules and regulations that govern these encounters, that's not a system failure, that's an individual failure. In order to make this into a system failure, what you have to do is to show that there was somebody at the top who either expressly or impliedly encouraged or condoned that kind of action so that you could attribute to the system at large. And in the case of Minnesota, it's a full progressive town. Whether you look at the governor, whether you look at the mayor, whether you look at the police chief under these circumstances, the attorney general, they're all strongly progressive. They have important differences amongst themselves, but it would take somebody's wildest dreams to say that any of them are racist or that any of them supported policies for the Department of the Police in Minneapolis, which was designed to intentionally single out and to have a disparate impact on African-American people. So that's the first version of this. The second version is that why is it that you assume that this conduct that was undertaken was in fact rogue or illegal, which is the way in which it has been both portrayed in the press and charged. And so for this particular situation, what you do is you look much more closely. And here what you do is you see a problem that always comes up when you watch videos, is it's always a part demonstration of what has happened. There are things that happened before and there are things that happened after. There are things that are done by sound which are not captured on the video at all. And what I did is I read a very powerful piece on the American Spectator by a man named George Parry. And it wasn't just a kind of speculative piece. It contained large segments of the transcript which had taken place over the entire episode. And if you read all of that stuff, if you looked at the autopsy reports, the counter-autopsy report that the lawyer Ben Crump ordered for George Floyd, it looks as though there was nothing illegal about the particular actions that are done. And this is a very common issue that you have in these cases. As a general matter, the criminal law works best in the following situation. You'll have somebody who is very active with a bad state of mind, who finds somebody else who is very passive, and what you do is you see the active person commit a shooting, that's called the actus reus, the guilty act, with an intention to kill, that's mens rea, the guilty mind, and the case is open and shut. And so what you do is you think of the hitman as the kind of paradigmatic case of the inexcusable case of murder one. The moment you start dealing with the police, there are always two complications that interfere with this. One is that policemen are privileged to use force under circumstances where ordinary individuals are not. And that secondly, it turns out that in many of these cases, it turns out that they are under pressure or attack from somebody or something. So that what you do is you don't have the luxury of premeditation. You have the instantaneous response, and that gives rise to two sorts of complications. One is that the homicide may well be justified because somebody was involved in this case who, in fact, was shooting at you. Or it may well be that the homicide is going to be excused or mitigated because the confusion and the uncertainty of the circumstances means that you can make a reasonable mistake, which will tend to either eliminate or to reduce liability. And if you look at all the major cases of which Floyd is one, they don't fall into this first category. They fall into the second category, which means that before you say or do anything, you have to take a deep breath. And now, since there's so much evidence by video camera and by audio tape, by official kinds of observations and so forth, by very precise autopsy, there's an enormous amount of information that you have to go through before you can make any kind of judgment. And it was at that level that the Floyd case broke down. The indictments were launched before the investigations were finished.
Walk me through the reactions that we've seen. So there are a lot of peaceful protests out there, as the defenders have been quick to assert, but it's hard to miss the places where this has spiraled into violence or looting or mass intimidation of police in some cases, private citizens in others. We've seen that in Portland. We've seen that in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in the wake of the Jacob Blake case. We've seen it in Washington, D.C. Now, we can, of course, stipulate that just as with the police videos, perhaps the images we're seeing don't tell the whole story. But as with the police videos, they surely tell part of the story. So, Richard, what ought to be the policy reaction here from mayors, from governors, even from the president? How ought they to be handling what oftentimes looks like anarchy on the streets of American cities?
Well, the first thing, of course, is that they would try to do is to play the same game that I mentioned with respect to Floyd, and show the before, the during, and the after, get collateral sources. The difficulty, as far as I can see, with respect to these mass movements is the more that you see of this stuff, the worse that it looks. That is, there's nothing which says that when you look at evidence which is not on the immediate video, that what you're going to find is evidence that exonerates. You may find evidence that intensifies. And so if it turned out there was something on the other side, somebody probably would have come up with it as a demonstrated way. I live in Chicago. Fortunately, I was not in town when both the June and the August riots took place. The first one was a mixture of peaceful demonstrations, which got out of control after dark. And the second one, as the mayor rightly pointed out, was a sheer out-and-out case of looting. All the information that you had is that people essentially loaded their U-Hauls, their vans, and in a coordinated fashion, what they descended on the downtown area, and they broke windows and shops and everything else. And so the situation was even worse than it appears. So the reality of this situation is there's no kind of evidence that you get from the outside that tempers. Well, when you start to do this at this particular point, what's the role of the public officials and so forth? Well, I think the first thing they have to do is they have to maintain order. And this means, in effect, that they have to be prepared to cordon off areas to impose curfews. There is no doubt whatsoever under the First Amendment that the only right you have is to be peaceably assembled. And if it turns out that you're going to have a mob of one sort or another, you can say, well, there are certain people in that mob who are peaceable, and so therefore you can't start the unlawful action because of the lawful action that takes place. Essentially, what you have to do is you have to lock down the cases. And then the second question is, if they continue to loot, what kind of force can you use against them? And this is one of these nightmare scenario questions for which there's never a very good answer. In the olden days, the answer was you could shoot to kill, and that meant live ammunition. I don't think that that's going to be particularly accepted today. And so now you start thinking, can you use stun guns? Can you use rubber bullets of some kind or another? Can you use tear gas? Can you use other kinds of lesser means? And the answer to that question is you surely can. There's no legality. The problem about this is these riots are not spontaneous. genius. They're planned and they're organized. They're Black Lives Matter people. They're Antifa. We don't know whether all people in these organizations will do this, but we surely know some. And so what happens is these guys come prepared. They have masks. They have tasers. They have various kinds of truncheons and so forth. So at this particular point, you're then faced with another nightmare scenario under the standard criminal law, which is if somebody decides to escalate against you and you cannot retreat, and policemen are never obliged to retreat under these circumstances. So what makes this extremely difficult is that there are then organized cases in which people come in from far and wide, heavily armed, and the issue is what kind of response should the police make? There used to be a kind of a standard rule that when there was mayhem and violence, the police could shoot to kill. Given the numbers of people who were involved here, given the obvious racial tensions in this particular situation, and given the risk of sheer carnage, that's not going to be plausible. So what you then do is you say, well, you have to use lesser means. And there are many of them. You can use stun guns. You could use rubber bullets. You can use various kinds of blockade techniques. You could use tear gas. What then makes this ever so much more difficult is that there are some people who come along, and they are now armed in order to fight the police. It's not just that they have only truncheons and so forth. Some of them have tasers and other kinds of devices. At that point, once the escalation fights, there is no adequate theory of self-defense which says, what is the appropriate response? The two words that are used from the beginning of time on this issue is the police are not allowed to use excessive force, but given the uncertainty, you don't know what force is or is not excessive, so they have to make a good faith judgment. Then it turns out that the force cannot be disproportionate to the wrong, but if it turns out that lives and property are now in risk, disproportionate force turns out to be a very weak constraint, and there are at least a lot of legal authorities that say, well, you may be able to shoot to kill under these circumstances, which again is not tenable. So the whole thing has degenerated. Well, if you understand that this is the way it's going to take place if there's a direct confrontation, if you're a mayor, the first thing you do is you put curfews in place, you cordon off situations, you put police cars, because you don't want the critical mass to establish so that you can avoid this scenario. And I have no question that these time, place, and manner restrictions in the face of a potential threat are always going to be valid. The ability of people to peaceably assemble is not going to be protected if it means that one person wants to peaceably assemble in the middle of a riot, you can shut him down. So you can basically have a somewhat overbroad kind of regulation because the people who want the peaceably protest could find thousands of other ways to do it. You have to shut down the rioters under these particular circumstances. So mayors have to take a very strong stand. Now, what's the key element with respect to this? Is you cannot show any sympathy whatsoever for the people who engage in the use of force, even if you have some sympathy for their larger political end. And the transformation that took place in Chicago with Lori Lightfoot is kind of instructive. The first two times there were riots within the system, she kind of had the police stand back, and she worried about the righteous indignation over George Floyd. The second time, she said, look, these are just plain old rioters. I'm not going to put up with any of this. And she just took a much tougher stance verbally. The third time that this was supposed to happen, which was this past Saturday on Michigan Avenue, I looked out my window and nothing was happening at all. So it's clear that if you basically make a very powerful, determined show before any of these things start to get together, it's much more effective than trying to stop the thing once it starts to careen out of control. Or to put it in the sort of simple terms, if you're running a railroad, there are two ways you could try to measure collisions, a master collision. One of them is to make sure that they don't happen, and the other is to try to stop the train as it's reeling off the tracks. You put all your energy into this first thing because, you know, no matter how much you do at the second stage, if that train is off the tracks, there's no way you could prevent massive destruction. And that has to be, I think, the key. And so when these governors essentially, or these mayors like in Seattle and so forth and in Portland, start to show sympathy with respect to the people whom they regulate, what they do is they essentially disarm themselves from the most powerful tool that they could have. They have to become much more proactive and much more forthright, and they have to say, I don't care what your political beliefs are. It's not the slightest concern to me. The moment I think there's a danger of a threat of force, we're shutting this entire area down, and if necessary, we will make arrests and we will charge. And this is only at the state level. Federal intervention, by the way, is possible, though very controversial, because many of these people move across state line, and it's been well established that criminal activity across state line is something that attracts federal jurisdiction. Even though wholly local criminal activity, it's much more difficult to sustain that particular approach.
Final question for you. Gallup has been doing polling on race relations for a long time. And in this century, the trend lines were pretty consistent for a while. Generally, a little over two-thirds of whites thought race relations were good, a little under two-thirds of blacks. More variability on the black side. It tended to dip more in bad moments. But this all starts to nosedive around the time of Ferguson and the Michael Brown situation back in 2014, and has continued to plummet. In the most recent data, it's less than half of whites that think the situation is good, and barely more than a third of blacks. And we know that in a social media era, every conflict is magnified. The most intense voices tend to be privileged over the more temperate ones. So I'm not asking you to solve American race relations in the last 5 minutes of the show, but what kinds of things do you think need to happen to not even remedy this, but just to get us back to the status quo ante?
Well, the first thing is that we give disproportionate attention to two or three incidents. The point I always like to make is that when you're running a society with 300 million people and you get a rate of compliance, which is something over 99.9%, right? You still got, you know, a couple hundred thousand people who are going to be making mayhem every day or potentially doing it. So there's no way that you could ever have a set of institutional constraints which will have a zero leakage rate. The base is too large. The outliers are too crazy. You just cannot do that. And you have to understand that. So the first thing you have to tell people, and it's very hard to admit, is to say, we run an ideal system and we shut down 99.9% of the difficulties. You will still see a case which will raise eyebrows every week, every other week. You cannot avoid that. But what you cannot draw is to do this is to draw inferences to say that the system is corrupt because you see these isolated events. That's the first point. The second point that you try to do is to say, look, let's look at certain things in comparison to the bad old days on issues which are not directly involved with the criminal system. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember the way in which segregation worked in the United States in the 1950s, and it was not a particularly pretty piece. And you start to talk about the sort of the day-to-day routine interactions between white people and black people that is absolutely transformed from what it was. And all the transformation has come from the better. People will constantly talk about implicit biases and lingering hatreds of one kind or another. But I think virtually everybody who may have these kinds of biases on either side is aware of that particular risk, and they take extra steps to try to overcome it. And so you see much more intermarriage, you see much more collegiality starting to take place. And every time you get a bad incident, you have to remind people of the enormous progress which has taken place on the ground. The other thing I think that one has to do is to make it very clear that the kind of militant separatist motions that you start to take place will not do anything that's very good. In universities and general discourse, the term anti-racism, which essentially was non-existent a year ago, is, I guess if you did a Google frequency search, is everywhere. A term like that, I think, is absolutely dangerous because it means that every time you start an interaction, there's one group who's got permanent victimhood and another group which is always going to be an oppressor. There is no way in which you could exonerate yourself from a charge which is not about any particular act that you've done, but just about your status. And so when you see these kinds of terms and you see the references to white supremacy and so forth, these are extremely divisive. They will rally some people, black people, in order to become really angry at whites. My guess is the majority of black people will actually be turned off by this. And it will basically turn white people who become extremely sensitive because they don't like being abused for being very bad human beings, when in fact in their day-to-day life they think they're pretty good kinds of people. So you have to tone down that kind of rhetoric if you wish to have any kind of degree of harmony. And you have to have people trying to cooperate rather than trying to confront. And I live in a university environment in which, you know, there's strong movements now to get every person who's a white supremacist, which means anybody who's a white faculty member, particularly male, particularly conservative, particularly interested in law and economics, to recant for sins which they don't even know that they have committed. This has to stop. You start looking at the kinds of affirmative action programs that have been put into place at Berkeley. It's just going to be absolute tinder. If you were to announce in Berkeley or in the California system that you believe in the great colorblind principles of Martin Luther King, you believe that the content of character matters more than the colors of some person's name, and you try to apply for a job, you will be summarily excluded from the pool, because what you have to do is to make a formal commitment in your own life to end racism wherever it exists and by whatever means that you have. And so what you do is you're forcing people to feel guilty. Many people will not say those things because they don't believe it. The applicant pool then completely turns over, and there are large numbers of people who are now excluded on this kind of ideological litmus test, which is only going to raise sentiments further. And the last thing we need to do is to have a justified anger on the white side to deal with the, quote, justified anger on the black side. And then what we do is we have people fighting this goal. So all of these movements of a rectification, which are taking place today in this very public way, I think are just likely to intensify the kinds of antagonism and make things look even worse than they are. And when I read the New York Times and the New Yorker and the Washington Post, with one inflammatory story after another, I say to myself, do these people hate Donald Trump so much that they're willing to sacrifice a nation in order to deny him a re-election? And I certainly hope the answer to that question is no, but I fear that it's yes.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at definingideas@hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter @RichardAEpstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.